Morning, everyone. Today's daf in Ksuvos is daf Sadi Beis. Sadi Beis represents a short daf in the Masechta. It'll give us an opportunity to catch up. We're not going to fully catch up today, but let's try to make back some ground that we have lost. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is Lonezecha Nishmat Libek Avriela Bashmuel. We are starting today on the very bottom of Sadi Amud Aleph. And we're going to start with the words Hani Tanai Ki Hani Tanai. It's about six lines from the bottom of the Amud. It's the first words in the line. We are speaking about Ksuvos Ben Indichrin. Ksuvos Ben Indichrin is a topic that's already been covered earlier in the Masechta, but here in the 10th parak we cover it again. There's an easy case and there's a complicated case, and if you've been around the Gemara long enough, you know the Gemara starts with the complicated case, and then later this morning we're going to get back to the easier case. So just in terms of a review, so let's reverse order. Let's go over the easy case of Ksuvos Ben Indichrin, just as a way of a general introduction, and then we're going to go to the more complicated case. The easy case of Ksuvos Ben Indichrin is as follows. A man's married to two wives, and he has children with both wives, and then he dies. But in the easy case, however, they're going to have both of the wives dying before he does. So both of the wives predecease him. And so now we know the halacha is, min haTorah, that he is Yorish, he inherits all of his estate of his wives, including the Ksuva. Now when I say inherits the Ksuva, obviously, we're not talking about the settlement that he has to pay them, meaning that's money still in his pocket. That's not what he's inheriting. But what he's inheriting is an adunya. There was a dowry. Both of the wives went into the marriage with assets that were given to them by their father, by their respective father. And so when they die and predecease him, so essentially now, not essentially, he inherits those assets, that estate. And then what's going to happen if the without rabbinic intervention is that the husband's going to die eventually, and then his entire estate, including that which he inherited from his two wives, are going to go drop down now to his children and be divided by his children. That's without any rabbinic intervention. Okay, the Chachamim were worried. If that were to happen, if what I just described happens, so then what's going to end up happening is that a woman's going to go into a marriage with a tremendous estate that was given to her by her father, by her wealthy father, and she's going to be married to a man with another woman, and then what's going to end up happening is that when the husband dies, so now her major estate that was brought into the family are going to get subdivided now between her children and between his children as well. And going all the way back now to the father-in-law, in other words, let's move back in time now to the point where the father-in-law is writing that check for the nedunya, for the dowry, so he's going to think not once, but he's going to think twice. Wait a second. I'm going to give my son-in-law already. Already he's thinking about his son-in-law. I'm going to give my son-in-law control and ultimately inheritance over this entire estate, and now he's going to then bequeath it over to his next generation, and there's going to be some children who are not my grandchildren are going to share it. No, thank you. And so it's going to really cause the father-in-law to pause and think to himself and say, you know what, I'm not writing in big nedunya. In other words, I love my grandchildren, but I don't love their siblings who are not my grandchildren, and I want the wealth to stay in the family. So it's going to really impede the father-in-law's willingness to write a large check. So therefore, the Chacham, and now we get into rabbinic intervention. And what the Chacham enacted is what's called Ksuvos Ben Indichrin. Ksuvos Ben Indichrin now will mean as follows. Again, I'll start with the simple case and then we'll move backwards to the complicated case. So in the case, simple case of Ksuvos Ben Indichrin, so what happens is a man's married to two women. Each one came in with a dowry. They both died before he did. Their estate went to him, meaning to their husband. I'm describing one person. And then the husband died. Freeze that moment right now. At that point in time, here comes Ksuvos Ben Indichrin, the rabbinic institution, in that. First things first, before any of the brothers touch any of the assets of the estate, first things first, each one of the children of their respective mother is going to get the entirety of the value of the Ksuva of their mother. So if one comes in with 1,000, the other one comes in with 500, so that means that the children of the 1,000 first get a distribution of 1,000. The children of the 500 get their distribution of the 500, and then whatever's remaining in the estate, that will be equitably divided through what the halachas is of Yerusha. This is called the Takanu Ksuvos Ben Indichrin. We've discussed it already a number of times. Good. And that's the easy case. And now we get to the complicated case. And in the complicated case, nothing really is going to change except for one important detail. And that is, in the complicated case, so the husband dies but is survived by one of the wives. So in other words, one of the wives predeceases him and the other wife survives him. So now we have a scenario in which one of the children are looking forward to getting Ksuvos Ben Indichrin, And the other set of children still have a surviving mother. So in other words, the husband didn't inherit the estate of their mother. So they're just looking at a regular Yerusha. And so now what we have is a very simple dilemma. Do the rabbis institute ksuvos ben indichron in such a scenario in which one set of children are looking towards ksuvos ben indichron, while the other set of children, the children of the second wife, I'm referring to the second wife simply because she just simply survived the husband. The children of the second wife who are not right now looking for ksuvos ben indichron, so there could be a lot of contention between them now, as usually, you know, money becomes a source of fighting. So here's a good scenario where one set of children are looking towards ksuvos ben indichron, and the other set of children still have a mother intact. And so therefore, for her mother's ksuva is just simply a chov, it's just simply an obligation. But not, it doesn't come through ksuvas ben indichron. And this is a complicated case. And so the first question that we raise, and we're going to address it again, is did the rabbis legislate, did they institute ksuvas ben indichron in such a scenario? That's question number one. Meaning in the simple case where both wives predeceased him, and he inherited both the assets of both of his wives, and then he dies. So good, ksuvas ben indichron, the enactment. But if only one of the wives predeceased him, so did the rabbis enact ksuvas ben indichron? That's question number one, that's the most basic question. Okay, question number two is going to be the following. And we, again, this is just a review from yesterday. I know it's a lengthy review, but it's a lot going on. Question number two is as follows. The rabbis enact the ksuvas ben indichron, but only, and again, we're going to go over this point again later this morning as well, but let's review it right now, but only. Only if, after the distributions of the mother's ksuva, there's still some assets left in the father's estate, so that there will be an equitable distribution of Yerusha. Meaning, the rabbis enacted ksuvas ben indichron, but not to the exclusion of Yerusha, meaning they don't want their rabbinic legislation to override Yerusha. So yes, each of the sons are going to inherit their mother's estate, but only if there is going to be a surplus after that, which will then qualify as Yerusha. If there's not, so then the Chachamim said, meaning if the assets of the estate are so limited, and if we were to divide the ksuvah towards each of the children, there'd be nothing left, so the Chachamim said, we back off. Meaning we're not going to institute ksuvas ben indichron, because we don't want ksuvas ben indichron, which is a rabbinic legislation, to override the halach of Yerusha min HaTorah. So now, the Gemara addresses another basic issue, and that's the following. In this more complicated scenario, where one wife survives a husband, so now she's holding a ksuva in her hand. So what does that make her? That makes her a creditor. Okay, she's a baal chov. In other words, the estate owes her. So now she comes in as a creditor. So imagine now where we have a scenario in which the father dies. Let's describe the scenario where his assets are extraordinarily limited, and now we have money going down to the children. And when I say children, I mean all the children. And there is a mother with an outstanding note, a receivable saying, a ksuva saying that the estate owes me money. Now let's just imagine for just a moment that he really died, not penniless, but with really limited assets, and all the mother's ksuva actually represents the entire value of the estate. Okay, so he really died with very little money. And so now the estate has to go off and pay the mother, and now the estate is left penniless. And the second question, which we're going to be addressing in just a moment, is, and we touched on this yesterday, but let's repeat ourselves again today, and that is, did the kids inherit? Meaning, is that called Yerusha? Meaning, do we consider the idea that when you inherit and there are outstanding payables against the estate, and we know that those payables are equal to or going to exceed that which I inherited, can we call that an inheritance? Knowing that if, after I get the money, I'm going to have to pay off the loans of the father. In this case, not the loans, but the obligations, i.e. the ksuva. Is that considered an inheritance? So that also touches on a very basic question, and the question is, even though you know the money came in, but you know the money's going to go out, is that called money coming in? Okay, that's question number two, which we're going to touch on. There's a couple of other ancillary questions, but those are the two main questions that we touched on. Let's go on. Let's see the Gemara inside. V'hani tanai ki hani tanai. The Gemara starts off as follows: six lines from the bottom of Tzadim and Beis. We're going to introduce ourselves to another brisa. Nasa Sirishano Mesa Nasa Sishniyam Mesu. So Man marries one woman, she dies. Man marries a second woman, he dies. Okay, so we are pretty much now in the scenario of he had two wives. It happens to be they weren't married at the same time, but in this regard it doesn't matter. He had two wives, one predeceases him, and one survives him. So, now, the sons of this one, already that's the ambiguity in the Braisa. Meaning the Braisa over here uses a pronoun. Okay, and so at this point, at this juncture, at this time, when we say that these come, the children of these come, we're going to assume that when we say these, we mean the second, the children of the second. V'nolin k'suva siman, and they take the k'suva of their mother, meaning they are in collections, and they're holding the k'suva of their mother, and the k'suva of the mother is an outstanding obligation that the estate owes her, so they come and they collect, period. Not period, but comma.
Why wouldn't the wife collect?
Huh?
Why wouldn't the wife?
So, mm-hmm. Right. So it's, in other words, either if the wife is there, she'll collect, or I guess the Braisa is just projecting a little bit into the future where the wife died, and they're going to still, but they're still entitled to that collection. Okay. Rabbi Shimon Omer, comma. Now, Rabbi Shimon Omer, im yesh mosa dinar elo notlin k'suvas imam ve elo notlin k'suvas imam ve im lav chol k'mishava. If there's a surplus of one dinar, so then these take the k'suva of their mother, meaning k'suvas ben indichrin, and they take the k'suvas of their mother, and the remainder of it is going to be divided with an equitable distribution through Yerusha. That is the two opinions in the Braisa. Now, there is obviously a debate. Meaning the way the Braisa is structured, we know the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon are arguing. What is the point of dispute between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon? It's not abundantly clear just from reading the simple wording of the Braisa, so the Gemara now is going to try to suggest that we are going to make a couple suggestions in terms of what their debate is. So maybe the issue over here is what we touched on in the introduction, and that is maybe the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon are arguing about whether or not this case even qualifies for the institution of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin, because both wives did not predecease him, only one wife predeceased him. So maybe what the Tanakhama's position is, no institution of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin. Meaning this is just going to be a regular case of Yerusha, and all payables have to go get paid. Okay, that's the Tanakhama's position. And Rabbi Shimon says, no, even in this case, there were two wives, the institution of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin is going to be instituted. To which the Gemara says, that's a possibility, but the Gemara says, lo. The Gemara says, no, that's... Gemara says, no, in this Braisa we just quoted, both the Tanakham and Rabbi Shimon say that even in this case, we're going to institute the institution of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin. And the Gemara suggests maybe there's another point of dispute between the Tanakham and Rabbi Shimon, and that is as follows. There's a surplus, but the surplus of a dinar is not represented by land, but rather by movables. And the debate over here between Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon is, does that surplus have to be land, or could it even be movables? Mar Savra Mekarkai in Metatale, Mar Savra Afil Metatale. And that could be the point of debate between the two of them. And so that's why, according to the Tanakhama, we're not going to institute Ksuvas Ben Indichrin for a very, very technical reason. And that is because there was a surplus, but the surplus was only immovables. Where, according to Rabbi Shimon, Tanakhama says that there was a surplus, but the surplus wasn't in... the surplus wasn't in land, it was only in movables, so therefore no institution of Ksuvas Ben Indichrin. And Rabbi Shimon says, a surplus of money is good enough. So to which the Gemara says, nice, but doesn't work out with what else, with other information. Omi matzis armez hachiv atanan. The Gemara is going to quote a Mishnah we're going to see later this morning. Rabbi Shimon Omer afilei sham nechasim shein lamachrayos enem klom ad sheyehei sham nechasim sheyesh lamachrayos yoser abeis ksuvas dinar. The Mishnah will say, this is the Mishnah coming up, it's in the very next Mishnah, which we'll see later this morning. The Mishnah says that according to Rabbi Shimon, the surplus must be land. Period. So it's a very nice way to explain the machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon of the Braisa, but it doesn't conform with the Mishnah. It's not going to work out. Elahacha. So the Gemara says, okay, let's try again. Hala elahacha b'dinah mishabde kemiflegi marsav b'mnecharinin mishabde lo marsav rafilu mishabde. So the Gemara says maybe we're going to suggest another explanation. That's the follow. Dad died. Not a lot of money. In fact, the money only is equal to the ksuvas of both mothers, and there is no surplus. But there's an outstanding receivable. In other words, dad is owed money from somebody. Or Rashi actually gives a different explanation of where the future money is coming from. Rashi describes how there's somebody in the family who's ready to die, and they stand to, and this estate stands to inherit it. Either way, in other words, there's a future money that's coming into the estate. So, for the purposes of ksuvas ben indichrin, do we need that surplus to be presently in the estate? Or can we look at an account receivable and say, look, that's money coming in, even though it's not here yet. Can that count towards the surplus? The Gemara suggests that's the machlokas. Ihachi, the Gemara says, look, that's also a very nice suggestion, but it doesn't fit in textually to the Braisa, because the Gemara is now going to review the actual wording of the Braisa. Rabbi Shimon Omer, im yesha moser dinar. So Rabbi Shimon says, if an account receivable qualifies as real assets that are currently there, so then it shouldn't be if, but kaven sheyesha moser dinar, because there's a moser dinar. So mi ba'ilei, that really should have been the better text of the Braisa, the better formulation. Ella, so the Gemara says, okay. Once again, back to the drawing board. There's a debate between the Tanakam and Rabbi Shimon. What are they arguing about? So the Gemara now makes another suggestion, which Gemara is going to reject also pretty quickly. And that is, maybe, what if there's a surplus, but the surplus is less than a dinar? Maybe that's what they're arguing about. So the Gemara says, but again, that's very difficult. Rabbi Shimon, dinar ka'amar. So the Gemara says, look, Rabbi Shimon, we know, is insistent that the surplus has to be a dinar in order to execute the rabbinic institution of ksuvas ben indichrin. He says it. He says in the Mishnah coming up. So once again, that really can't be the debate as well. V'chi tema epoch. Now let's flip everything around. Now, 99 out of 100 times when you see the Gemara saying the word epoch, what the Gemara is doing is flipping around the opinions of Rabbi Shimon and the Tanakhama. And that way it'll work out. But over here, that's not what it means. Epoch, says Rashi, over here means that when we read the Braisa and we saw that pronoun, we assumed that it was going on the children of the second wife. What we're going to suggest now is we're talking about the children of the first wife. Let's go back to that Braisa. Let's read it again as what the Gemara now is suggesting. Going all the way back to where we started this morning on the bottom of Sadi Amad Aleph, back to the Braisa, reading the Braisa one more time. Nasa Rishon Omesa, he marries one wife, she dies. Nasa Sashin Omesu, marries a second woman, and he dies, she survives him. Baim Banesh Shozu, the sons of this one. So once again, we thought, up until this point in time, it meant the children of the second wife. But now what we're suggesting is, Zu means children of the first wife. Lachamisa v'notlin ksuvas iman, and they take the value of the ksuva of their mother. Okay. Rabbi Shimon Omer, okay, good. So now what we're suggesting is that really the Zu is talking about the children of the first. So Tana Kama Damasni Nami Dinar Kamar. So the Gemara says, I'm sorry, Vahar Rabbi Shimon Dinar Kamar Vechitema Epoch. So Tana Kama Damasni Nami Dinar Kamar. So the Gemara says, yeah, but once again, even if we did that, which would work, but again, to suggest that there is an opinion out there that says that if you have a surplus less than a dinar, we're going to institute ksuvas ben indichrin. But once again, we know everybody, both the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon, both insist that the surplus has to be a dinar. Elaki hanach trei lishnai kamai ve'epoch. So the Gemara says, okay, so here's what we're going to do. What we're going to do is we're going to work with our most recent understanding that when the Braisa describes Zu, it's talking about not the children of the second wife, the children of the first wife. And by the way, Alex, that helps out your question that you asked earlier, meaning how could we talk about the children of the second wife when she's still around? So good. So according now to our current understanding, there are no children to the second wife. We're describing the children of the first wife. Second wife is still alive. And now, all we'll do is we'll just simply inject one of the earlier explanations, because now one of the earlier explanations is going to work out. Either it's land versus movables. That was an earlier suggestion. It could be shibud versus non-shibud property, meaning account receivables versus not. And now it comes out that in both of those cases, according to the Tanna Kamma is of the opinion that for movables, well, institute ksuvos ben edikrin. And Rabbi Shimon says, no, it's got to be land. So in other words, based on that change of pronoun, now it works out what we suggested earlier. Now the pshat works out well, according to either one of the earlier suggestions. Okay. And finally, after all said and done, now the Gemara comes to a conclusion. So the Gemara says, we're going to state two halachas now. Number one is that, even if it's not the classic scenario where both of the wives predecease him, and he inherited both of the estate, both of the ksuvas of both wives, and then he dies, for sure that's the classic case of ksuvas ben indichrin. But even the more complicated case where only one of the wives dies and one of the wives survives him, we're still going to institute and legislate ksuvas ben indichrin. Good. That's halacha number one. Gemara says that put that one in the books. Number two, ksuva nasas mosa l'chaverta, on the issue of if and when you inherit, there are still outstanding obligations that you have to pay off. And those outstanding obligations are either equal or exceed that which you inherited. It's still called an inheritance. What difference does it make? Because now we would institute ksuvas ben indichrin, even in a scenario where after the sons inherit and they have to pay off the ksuva of one of the wives, but because they inherited, so that's considered a yerusha, and therefore we're going to institute ksuvas ben indichrin.
Is the ksuva ben indichrin looked upon as a loan or something?
Inheritance. Yeah. Right. So bishlam iyash minan. Right. That's the right question, because if it's a loan, so then right. Correct. The Gemara now is going to get extraordinarily technical, and that is, look, that we just stated the halacha. You know, but you had to say both halachas, meaning, can't you be a little bit more concise? Just give me one of those two halachas, and can we deduce one from the other? So the Gemara says, look, I wouldn't have deduced the second point from the first point. Because hava mina iika mosa dina ina ilo lo. Because the first point is just telling us that this is a case where we would institute ksuvas ben indichrin. However, if the ksuva of the wife exceeds the estate, is equal to or exceeds the estate, I might have thought we don't call that a Yerusha, and therefore we wouldn't institute ksuvas ben indichrin. Ela lishmin ksuvas nasa demotel chaverta v'ani yadana mishum da'achas b'chayev achas mamosi yasham ksuvas ben indichrin. However, Gemara wonders, once I know the second point, I know the first point. Meaning, what was the second point? Second point is that even though a woman is coming with her ksuva looking to collect her obligation, and let's say that represents the entire estate, but that's still considered like a Yerusha. Once I know that, so then obviously the only reason why we're having this discussion is because we want to institute ksuvas ben indichrin in this scenario. So once I know point number two, I already go back and I know point number one. Gemara says, not so quickly. I might have thought, if all I had was point number two, I might have thought as follows. Yes, it's true, there is a woman with a ksuva looking to collect from the estate, but maybe it's a very limited scenario. What would the scenario be? Let's say this man married three wives. Two predecease him, and one survives him. Now the one that survives him and ultimately dies has only but a daughter. So now, in terms of Yerusha, she's out of the picture. Meaning, because there are sons from the first two wives. So, in the case, and remember, the inheritance is exclusively from the father to the children. So she's a daughter, she's not getting part of the Yerusha. Fine. So then I might have thought in that case we're going to institute ksuvas ben indichrin. Because what kind of fighting are we talking about? Meaning, the sons that are there that are standing to inherit are not competing with that daughter whose mother survived the death of the father. However, v'las bas Yerusha, and she's also not getting Yerusha. So there's no concern about fighting. But we go back to the the regular complicated case of one dies before him, one dies after him, and now look, there's fighting because although there's a question of ksuvas min indichrin, there's also an outstanding ksuva that looks to be collected as well, and now we have Yerusha and we have obligations that we're fighting over. I might have thought that in such a case the rabbis would not have dictated or legislate ksuvas min indichrin. And if that third wife who survived him had a son, I might have thought we would not have instituted ksuvas ben indichrin. That's why, when given over the halacha, Mar Zutra had to say that in the classic scenario, not classic, but in the simpler version of two wives, one dies before him, one dies after him, both of them have sons, still the rabbis instituted ksuvas ben indichrin. And then point number two is that even if the ksuva obligation equals or exceeds the estate, that's still considered like a Yerusha. Period. Ad kan. That takes us to the end of the more complex scenario. And now we continue with today. We're on the Mishnah on the bottom of Tzadi Aleph Amid Aleph. And now we are going to deal with a nice, easy case. Misha Yanasu Shei Nashim, the man's married to two women, Umesu V'Achar Kach Mesu. Both women die. He inherits the ksuvas of both of these women, and then he dies. V'Yasomim Mavakshim Ksuvas Imam. So, and the children are saying, wait. Slow down. Before any monies are divided through Yerusha, first things first, let's get the ksuva of our mother. Again, they know about ksuva's been in Dechrin. They are essentially asking, first we're going to get our mother's ksuva, the dowry written into the ksuva of our mother, and then after that, then we'll divide whatever's the remainder of the estate, the balance of the estate. However, if the estate is equal to the two ksuvas, so then, by us doling out the ksuvas to the two children, that means that there won't be any Yerusha? No. Hayesha Mosa Dinar, as long as there is a surplus of one dinar over that of the ksuvas, so then, and only then, Elo Not L'Ksuvas Imam, Elo Not L'Ksuvas Imam. Good. Then the institution of ksuvah has been indichrin. Imam Yisom Emanachnu Ma'alem Al Nechse Avinu Yafed Dinar Kedei She'ilu Ksuvas Imam Ein Shomen Lahem. The Mishnah says as follows. Let's say there are two sets of children, one from one mother, one from the other mother. One set of children knows that their mother's ksuvah was enormous. Their grandfather was wealthy and gave that wealth over to their mother. And now mom died, dad had the estate, now dad dies, and look, they're having a conference with each other. Look, our mother's ksuva is huge, and our brothers from the other mother, their mother's ksuva is not large. And right now, here's the problem. If we're not going to be able to collect our mother's ksuva because the entire estate is not exceeding the value of our two ksuvas, meaning our mother's ksuva and our brother's mother's ksuva. So, let's do the following. Let's artificially inflate the value of the estate. In other words, what do we need? We need a moser dinar. We need a surplus after. Okay, you need a surplus? No problem. So in a case where you don't have money, let's create money. We're not creating money, but let's pretend like, pretend, right? Let's, basically, that's what it is. Let's artificially inflate the value of the estate. So now, well, right. So now, after the ksuvas are divided, there'll still be a leftover for the Yerusha. So the Mishnah says, as you can well imagine, the Mishnah says, no, you can't do that. In other words, whatever the appraised value of the estate is, that's the appraised value of the estate. You go to Beis Din, you do an appraisal of the estate, and whatever that number comes in as, that's the number. And if it exceeds the two ksuvas, so then a division of the two ksuvas, then a division of the Yerusha. Otherwise, Yerusha. Hi, Yusham. Just give me one second. Hi, Yusham. Nechasim karai einan kibemuchzak. Now, in terms of determining that surplus, can we look at the receivables? I know we touched on this before, but now we're learning the Mishnah. So this is a source. So can we look at receivables as to trying to determine whether or not there's a surplus? So the Mishnah says, no. It's not viewed as money that is currently in the estate. And then here's the opinion of Rabbi Shimon. Again, we talked about this earlier, but here's the Mishnah. Rabbi Shimon says, a surplus dinar is only considered a surplus dinar if it's represented by land. but not if it's represented by movables. So yes, we'll institute ksufas ben indichrin, but only if there's a surplus of land greater than a dinar than that of the two ksufas. Okay, yes, Eddie.
Can they devalue their own, the ksufa that they own?
Can they?
In a self appraising higher.
Okay.
Devalue their own.
Correct. Okay. I assume the answer is no, but okay. It's
why would they want to do that?
Why would they want to do that? Because then, right, correct. In other words, whatever they devalued it is going to be far exceeding the than a balanced division of the estate. Tanu Rabbanan, lezu alav lezu chamesh meos. Okay, again, classic scenario, two wives, they both die, then the father dies, the husband, I should say, dies, and then now all that estate is coming over to the children, and one mother's ksuva represents 1,000. One mother's ksuva represents 500. And the Braisa says, if there's a surplus within the estate, so then there's a division of ksuvas ben indichrin, followed then by a equitable division of the balance, and otherwise we go straight to equitable division of the Yerusha. What did we learn in this Braisa that we didn't already know from the Mishnah? Why did the Gemara quote this Braisa? Unclear. I will suggest that maybe the Braisa just wants to demonstrate that we're talking about, think about what we're doing with that estate. Meaning, one set of kids is going to get when all said and done, it won't be twice as much, but just from the division of the ksuva, one set of kids is getting two times more than the other set of the kids. Let's put it simply, that's not fair. But that's exactly the point. Ksuva has been indifferent. Meaning, correct. That's.
But it came from your grandfather. Wasn't
that's
father,
that's correct. 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 That's rabbinic intervention. Correct. Okay. Offhand, that's what I can think of in terms of why. Otherwise, the Bryce is not telling us anything new. Pshit. The Son Barzel is part of what the husband inherited.
Oh, he's
right. Tan Rabbanan. I'm sorry, Pshita. We're on the bottom of Tzadi Aleph Amid Aleph. Pshita Merubim Nismatu Kvar Zachu Behem Yorshim. Okay, we see this all the time, especially with properties. You know, values of properties go up, values of properties go down. There's a fluctuation. And the Gemara starts off like this. Let's say at the time that dad died, so there was an appraisal done at the time of death, and it comes out that the estate exceeds the two ksuvas. Great. So we're ready to institute ksuvas ben indichrin. And then, right, the property values go down. And now, as they're ready to divide the estate at a later point in time, so now it's less. The two ksuvas are going to be, the estate is going to be less than the value of two ksuvas. So to that, the Gemara says, it is obvious. Kvar zachu b'hem yorshim. In other words, of course, we'll follow the fluctuating value of the land, but in terms of instituting ksuvas ben indichrin, we look at the point of death, we freeze frame that moment, and it's at that point in time we take a snapshot of what its value is worth, and if at that point in time it exceeds the two ksuvas, so then we institute ksuvas ben indichrin, even though at a later point in time the prices went down, and it actually represents less than, the entire state is less than the value of the two ksuvas. Gemara says that's obvious. However, here's where it does not get obvious. Mu'atim v'nisrabu mai. But let's go the other direction. Let's say at the time of death, the estate was not worth the two ksuvas. And so therefore, at that moment, we're ready to make just a simple, equitable distribution of the estate through Yerusha. And then what happens is, before, you know, everything gets settled, and we're actually ready to now divide the estate, then what happens is prices go up. And now in the current setting, let's say it's a year after the death of the father. And now in the current setting, so now it actually is greater than two ksuvas. I know one set of children are not going to be arguing ksuvas ben indichrin, but can the set of sons who are standing to inherit a large sum of money from the ksuva of their mother, can they now argue and say, look, currently the estate is more than the two ksuvas combined? So can we look at the current situation? Tashma, Denichse, Debate, Bar Tzirtzer, Muatim, Vinisrabu, Hava, the Gemara cites that there was an actual scenario where this happened, Vasil Kamid, Rav Amram, and the case came in front of Rav Amram, Amalu, Zilo, Paisinu. So Rav Amram says, go work it out. Meaning, what else am I supposed to tell you? I mean, Yerusha, right? You inherit. At the time of death of the parent, there wasn't the estate did not exceed the tuksuvas. Yerusha. In other words, go get lost. Lo ashkechu. Now they didn't want to hear from it. Amalu ilam if I see saluhu. To which Rav Amram says, look, I'm telling you what the halacha is. Go work it out. Go settle. But you don't want to listen to me. Literally, the words mean I'll hit you with a thorn that doesn't extract blood. But as Rashi points out over here, I'm going to excommunicate you if you don't listen to me. So Shadrin will come to Rav Nachman Amalahem, and the case went to Rav Nachman. Now Rav Amram already ruled on the issue. So Rav Nachman was what? He was like a superior judge. He was like a, it was like an appeals court, maybe something along those lines. Anyway, the case came to Rav Nachman, and he says, "Kishem shemarubin benismatu zachu bahem yorshin, kach muatem nisrabu zachu bahem yorshin." Rav Nachman's answer, according to Rashi, Tosfos doesn't agree, but I'm going to present the Gemara nice and simple, like Rashi. You take a snapshot. Of the estate at the time of death, and that's what it is. So, regarding of fluctuating values, if at the time of death it was greater than the two ksuvas, so then an institution of ksuvas ben indichrin. If at the time of death it was less than the two ksuvas, so then no institution of ksuvas ben indichrin, and just a simple distribution of the estate through the halachas of Yerusha. Period. Gives me now a second to brief. We are on the top of Sadi Aleph Amud Beis. We are now at the two dots. The Gemara gives us a simon because we're going to see now a number of case studies. So from here until the rest of what should be today's daf is Sadi Beis, we are going to go through case study after case study where some of them are related to Arishuk Suvas Ben Indichrin, and then we're just going to go off the board and we're going to just go with other cases. Okay, now some of these cases are complicated. Just takes a little bit of thought. I know I'm going to go through them quickly, quicker than I'd like to, but okay. Let's start off with the following. How gavra dava maske be alfei zuzei? The person owed 1,000 zuz. How vele trei apadne? And he was a borrower, this person. And he had two palaces. Okay, let's call it two homes. So Avinu chada b'chamesh meos v'chada b'chamesh meos. He sold off the two properties, one for 500, one for 500. Now these properties were mortgaged against the money that he owed. So asa b'alchov, tafla chada minayu. So in comes the b'alchov, now comes the creditor. And, like he's rightfully entitled to do, he has a lien on the property. So he comes and he takes. Now, really, the truth of the matter is he's entitled to both houses. Because he's a creditor who has a $1,000 note outstanding. So he's going to now foreclose on the properties. So he's coming and he takes the first property, which only satisfies half the debt. And now, hadar katarfli idach. And now he wants to take the second property as well. So now he's going to the buyer of the property, and now he's going to come and he's going to collect his second property to satisfy the remainder of the loan. So shaka alfa zuzav ka'azal agabein. So now in comes the buyer. So yeah, everyone understand we have a borrower who ends up selling the property. We have the balchov, that's a creditor. And we have the actual buyer of the property. The three people involved in this case. And the buyer now goes over to the creditor. And the buyer says to the creditor, look, Amarle, Ishavi lachalfe zuzei lachaye. Look, I don't want you taking both of these houses. I really like the second house. Okay, the first house, okay, whatever. By the way, I'm not sure if I made this exceedingly clear. Let me just make this clear. Both houses were bought by one buyer. Okay, good. Now that I made that clear. So the buyer says, look, you came and you took the first house. Okay, I understand. You had to lean on that property. Here's what we're going to do. You want to come to take the second house? I don't want you to take the second house. I bought it. I like it. Okay, leave me alone. Now, I understand. You have a lien. I get it. How much of a lien we're talking about? You're talking about 1,000. You already collected one house. Look, I know that house I bought out of 500 and it appraises for 500. I know that. I understand that. But if you want to look at that house as 1,000 and say that the loan is settled, that's good. However, if you don't want to do that, so here's what I'm ready to do. I'm ready to reach in my pocket, take out $1,000, By the way, parenthetically, another $1,000. Remember, he already bought these houses once before, so I already shelled out $1,000. But I'll reach into my pocket. I'll take another $1,000, and I'll settle the mortgage with you. Good. Now,
does he have that option?
Huh? Good. That's the right question. So, and I'll settle the mortgage with you. And so, Savar Rami Bar Chama LeMeimar Hayna Masdisin. So Rami Bar Chama says, wait a second. Before let's go back to what his first suggestion was. You took already a home that was worth 500 to satisfy the note that was 1,000. And the first offer that the buyer made to the creditor was, if you could look at that home as 1,000 and let's just be done with it. Meaning good. So basically what he was asking him to do was artificially inflate the price of the home so that it satisfies the note. And are you allowed to do that? So Rami Bar Chama says, hey, I know a Mishnah and Shas that speaks to that. Now, by the way, as a parenthetical note, we're learning the Mishnah right now today in today's daf. So for like us, we're like, oh yeah, that is the Mishnah we just learned. Can you imagine like having not seen the Mishnah in some time, meaning to have that kind of familiarity with all the Mishnayos? It's impressive. I mean, I just to think about for a moment how well, I mean, I'm making an obvious point, but just for us to absorb, how well these Tanaim knew the Mishnayos. Really, we should know them this well. But how well they knew the Mishnayos that, you know, a case comes up and they're thinking, artificially inflating a price, and they go through the Rolodex of Mishnayos in their mind. Yep, okay, yeah, 10th Perek of Ksuvos, of course. It's you know. So, Hayna Masnissen, so he says, oh, that's a Mishnah. Look, what did our Mishnah say? That one set of brothers can't go to another set of brothers and say, let's artificially inflate the value of the property so there's a surplus of a dinar. And what the Mishnah say? Get lost. No, you can't do that. So here also, Rami Bar Chama says, you can't artificially inflate the price of the house. And even though it was appraised and sold at 500, let's call it 1,000. You can't do that. Amalei Rava Midami. So Rava says, you know, those cases are not comparable. Because in our Mishnah, by artificially inflating the price of the properties, essentially what one brother wants to do, the other set of brothers is, hey, we want more money. So by artificially inflating the price of the property, we're going to end up getting our mother's ksuva, and you're going to get your mother's, and we're going to get more money in. Obviously, no. In other words, so that's an artificial inflation, which will end up causing a loss to another party. But over here, what kind of loss are we talking about? Meaning the creditor was owed 1,000. He already took one house, and its value was 500. And look, the buyer said to him, if you want to view it as worth 1,000 to you, which... If you want to do that, that's fine. And if you don't want to do that, so then I'll give you 1,000. But in other words, for the creditor's standpoint, if he wants to accept the offer, so for him, it's valued at 1,000. And if he doesn't want to accept the offer, he's going to get 1,000 for his loan.
What if the value of the house had appreciated from 500 to 1,000? Does the lender go to the
It's a good question. I don't off the top of my head, I don't know the answer. But again, let's just deal with the case at hand. So, fine. So the Gemara says, so Rava disagrees with Rami Bar Chama. Rava says it is a fair offer that the buyer is making to the creditor. Okay, now, let's say, now in all these cases, in any case where there's a lien and the lien holder comes and it forecloses on the property, and in this particular case, so now property was taken away from the buyer. So what's the buyer's recourse? Buyer's going to go back to the seller and say to the seller, look, you know what just happened? your creditor came and took the property away from me. Now, did he know that at the time when he bought the property? Let's say yes. Let's say yes. And let's say that when the property was sold to him, it was sold to him with what's called achrayus, a guarantee. So in other words, there is a recourse in that now the buyer of the property can go back now to the seller of the property and say, properties were taken away from me, you have to reimburse me. Now, good luck to him, because, in other words, he had a hard time paying off his first creditor, and so now, what kind of real reimbursement is he going to get from this guy? I understand. But on the books, the buyer is, in fact, entitled to to get reimbursed. Interesting question the Gemara now is going to deal with, and that's as follows. V'tirfa b'kama kasvinan. Now, Gemara wants to know, we are going to be writing him a receipt. In other words, because what would happen is from the buyer, creditor came and took land away from him. Now, in the event that, let's say, the creditor took the $500 property, and the creditor was like, you know what, I like this property so much, you know what, I'm good. I'm just going to walk away with this $500 property, and I don't, in other words, you keep the other one at the $500, and again, the Gemara, assuming the halacha is like Rava, they're all in agreement that that's so. And now we're going to write a reimbursement note, a receipt, so to say, to the buyer, so that the buyer will go back to the seller and say, hey, look, you owe me. How much is he writing that receipt for?
$500.
Either it's going to be for one of two. It's either going to be for $500 or it's going to be for $1,000. $500 because that's the land that was taken away from him. $1,000 because that was the amount that was actually owed to the creditor. In other words, what this buyer just did is he just satisfied a $1,000 debt. Even though he did it with a $500 property, but he just satisfied a $1,000 debt. So when you're writing a receipt for this guy so that he can go back for a reimbursement from the seller, so a simple question. Do you write a receipt for $500? Do you write for $1,000? Machlokas. Ravina Amar Ba'alpha. Just one second. Ravina Amar Ba'alpha. Rav Avir Amar Ba'chameshmea. So, debate. Ve'ilchasa Ba'chameshmea. And the Gemara says that the receipt that's going to be written is going to be for $500. The Gemara says that's the halacha. Who's writing it? The creditor. Meaning the creditor is going to say, note satisfied. I seized the property away. He's going to write it to the buyer. And now the buyer is going to come back to the seller and say, okay, you're off the hook with him. now say hello to me. Yes.
Why can't you say the creditor just forgave half the loan and that's it? Finish. You about inflating, not inflating. I forgive $500. That's it. Just write me a check. I'll receive the $500.
So good. So that explains the opinion of $500.
Inflation here is just he forgave half.
Okay. In other words, right? Okay. You could have looked at it that way, but in other words, but he has a lien on both of those properties. Okay.
The buyer only asked for 500 receipts.
Which is the Gemara's conclusion. Yeah, okay, good. Okay, that was all case number one. Let's go, case number two.
In general, can the buyer ask, if there's a creditor he wants to keep, can he just...
Generally speaking, right, if my memory is good, which it's okay, so generally speaking, so when a creditor comes to the buyer, so generally speaking, the buyer can give him money.
Okay.
In other words, there's a basic question of, when I have a lien on a property, how connected, how attached am I to that property? Am I a partial owner of that property, or no, that property just simply serves as security against my obligation. That's really the fundamental question, which is, you know, in different versions throughout the Gemara, that the Gemara has that kind of debate. Okay, how gavadavim maskebe meazuzeh havalei trei katine dare. The second story is going to be basically a mimic of the first story. Just the numbers are going to be smaller. Okay, so I'll go through this quickly. There was a guy that owed $100, and he had a small piece of land. Two small pieces of land, and he sold both of those properties. Again, let's say he sold it to one guy. Each one of them he sold for 50. And then along comes the creditor and he takes one of the properties. And he wants to come now take the second property. And the guy goes to him with 100 zuz in his pocket and he says the following to him. Look, that first property that you took, if you would like to overpraise it, artificially inflate it to the value of 100 and say that settles the debt, good. And the elo shakel kufzuzi vistalik. If you don't want to do that, so here I have 100 zuz in my pocket, and I'm gonna settle the obligation with you, and I'll take back that first property that you took, and good. And then obviously I'm gonna have to go back to and get a reimbursement. Sav Rav Yosef Lamemar, Haina Masnisani, Mamma Yosomim Vichule. Now Rav Yosef says you can't artificially inflate property, like we learned in our Mishnah. Amle Abayim, Midami Hasam Islay Psidal Yasme Hachamai Psidi Islay Meah Yav Me Shakil. And to which Abayi says to Rav Yosef, no. Again, there's a difference. In our Mishnah, by artificially inflating value, someone's going to lose. In this case, no one stands to lose. Because if the guy is so enamored with that first property that he's ready to keep it and satisfy the loan, fine. And if he doesn't, He'll get a full reimbursement of his loan, so no one's going to stand to lose. Okay. V'tarfik v'kama yasvinan. And again, let's just review. Now there's going to be a reimbursement note being written for the buyer, and that's going to be for how much? Ravina amar b'meir, ravavir amar b'chamish v'yuchus b'chamish, and the Gemara once again concludes that's going to be 450. How gavda v'maske b'meir zuzay, shachiv shacha ketina da'ar da'avishav v'chamishim zuzay. There was a person who owed 100 zuz, he dies, and it was a small piece of land and was worth 50 zuz. That's about chav v'katar of leg. So along comes a creditor who's got a lien on the property, and he takes it. And so far, half of his notice is satisfied. So the sons come, the children come of the estate, and they say, we want that property. So what they did is they gave the creditor $50. So how did Katara flay? And so what the creditor did is he took the property a second time. And it makes perfect sense because only half the note was satisfied. So now that they have a piece of property on their hands, good, thank you very much, I'll take that. So they go to Abaye for a ruling. And Abaye says, look, when your father has outstanding debt and he dies, in other words, you want to honor your parents. One way to honor your parents is to pay off the debt. In other words, it's not right. Think about what everyone's going to be saying about dad as he died and he had debts to pay. So mitzvah lefroa chov avihen. There is a commandment. Now, the nature of that commandment, the degree of that commandment. See Rashi over here for a discussion of that. For our purposes, time considering, we're going to finish off this story. In other words, what they did with that first 50 is they did a mitzvah. So hani kamai mitzvah vidatayhu. So that means that the first 50 that they paid off, we're gonna file that under good. You did the right thing. Hashi kitarf bedin kitarf, and that means what? That means that the land. I'm sorry. That means that when they paid 50, they didn't buy back the land. They didn't satisfy the mortgage. You know what they did? They started paying off the dad's debt. So then when they took back the land, there still existed a mortgage on that property. The creditor still had a mortgage. So So now when the creditor comes back and seizes that property a second time, he's perfectly within his right because he still had a mortgage on that property. The Gemara makes one proviso on this case, and that is v'lo amarin d'lo amar le hani chamishim zuzay demei da'ar katine aval amar le hani chamishim zuzay demei ar katine saluk itzalkua. But on this, the Gemara makes one last point, and that is that if when the kids gave the first 50, they articulated and they said, this is for the purpose of satisfying the mortgage on this property. So now, good. Mortgage is settled. Mortgage is satisfied. And then, that means that the creditor still has an outstanding loan of 50, but no longer has a mortgage on the property. And so there, I don't know how he's going to collect, but in the event that he'll collect, but not from that property. That property was relieved of its mortgage. Okay, we'll stop over here. We're up to story number, I numbered it in my Gemara. We're up to story number 4. Okay, so tomorrow we'll start with story number 4.